Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, wherever you are. I hope you are having an absolutely glorious day. Today we're going to be talking about something that, well, I believe all of us are going to have to deal with. And what is it? Well, it's actually the title of the book that we're going to be discussing today, Objects of Our Affections. And my guest is Lisa Tracy, and she's going to be talking about what it was like to go through items that belonged to her family, learn about history and all kinds of things that otherwise she might never have even had a curiosity about. I want to welcome Lisa to the show.
Thank you. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Lisa. You have had an interesting life. You were the former editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer. You worked at as a home and design editor. Also, you worked with a Sunday magazine. You've done a lot with writing, but this situation with your family's treasures. Now, you live in Virginia.
Yes.
What was it with your mom? I mean, after she passed away, because this book is so interesting. You have so many items in it. And I want to quote a poem that was written apparently in the 14th century. You have it right in the front of your book. Too much furniture in one's living room, too many pens in a stand, too many children in a house, too many words when men meet, too many books in a bookcase that can never be.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
I think that says a lot about the human condition. That was a philosopher in Japan in the 14th century, and you hear him saying there's too much of this and there's too much of that, and you're like, yeah. And then at the end he says, you can never have too much. And you say, what? What? And that's our problem, you know. And as the wealthiest country in the history of the world, really, we've had unlimited almost capability on a lot of levels. Many people have had the capability to explore what it's like to just have more and more stuff. Mm-hmm. And suddenly we come to a screeching halt when we have to downsize, or our parents have to downsize, or the kids go off to school or whatever it is, and we realize, and we have these moments of realization and dread when we see that we have to deal with the things. And what I discovered after Mommy died, and the stuff sat in storage for almost 10 years until...
Oh, my goodness.
It's just my sister and me. And, you know, at that point in Virginia, the storage was pretty inexpensive. It was only like, you know, $100 a month, and one or the other of us was paying for it. So we sort of didn't notice, and then all of a sudden I stopped and I said to my sister, what are we doing with all this stuff? We're not using it. We haven't sold it. We're both grown-ups. We have a house full of furniture. We'd each taken a few things that we treasured. So anyway, long story short, it eventually led us to an auction, and that was kind of a painful experience. But mm-hmm. Ultimately, in the long run, it was very liberating. But what I learned from that was that the thing that I think really slows everybody down is the stories that are in the furniture. We are a storytelling animal, and we put our stories, our loved ones, we sort of make a little nest in our things, we make a home out of our things, and we carry things with us, and I think it's the stories that are in the things that really catch us in the end.
I find it coincidentally synchronistic. I'll use those words together, because last night I was having dinner with some people, and we were chatting. And the ladies there were talking about how they had dealt with various experiences, you know, family members like you, your mom passing. They had had family members that had passed away. But a couple of these ladies are getting up into their 80s.
Oh,
and
yes.
And so now they're saying, we are wanting to do things. And one lady had a very interesting approach. She watches younger people. And she said, if I feel that they would appreciate what I want to give them, I gift them.
Yes.
And she has done this. And I remember when I was a young married woman, a wonderful couple did that for me and my husband. And we didn't have any money. And mm-hmm. they knew that. But they also knew that we would be wonderful custodians of some of the beautiful things they had. And, you know, when I was reading your book, I was thinking about so many different experiences that clients have told me that I have had personally, things that I've seen as a counselor that families have gone through mm-hmm. when they have to liquidate an estate, the
yes.
good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yes.
And then I read your story, and I really liked the information you brought out. For example, with you opened one drawer. I mean, I don't know, how long did it take you guys to go through all these stuff? How big a storage place did you have?
We had two bins of the, you know, the sort of the
mm-hmm.
normal size. So it was a substantial amount of stuff, and there was the one big box of papers. So you were saying, you know, I had opened a drawer. Which one are you talking about?
The one that you said had all the wills and
yes.
journals and all of these papers. You know, you watch the Antique Roadshow and people go, this is worth $50 million. My God, do I have one of these?
Well, that particular day was really a shock because it was the beginning of the process of dismantling my mother's house, and she was still alive. She was going to go to a retirement home, so we were packing the house up in pursuant to that.
Mm-hmm.
And the moving man, Roger, was about to come, and he interrupted me as I opened this drawer, and I saw my mother had compiled a lot of family papers, and she'd had the sense to put them all in one place. But, you know, we hadn't sorted through them at all, and she knew more than we did, and we didn't get to her about it until after it was too late.
Mm-hmm.
I did have the sense to put all of that stuff in one box that I would recognize again, and then later we started to sift through it, and all these pieces of stories were there. But, you know, what I tell people is that people say, oh, well, the young people don't care, they won't listen, and I keep saying, we have to record this stuff anyway while we're here, because they are going to want to know about our history at just about the time when we are no longer available to tell them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it was with Mother. We sort of took it for granted. She was hearty and hale and strong and very strong-willed, and then she died suddenly, and she fell, broke her hip, you know, and the whole thing took its course from there very quickly. We never expected that. We thought we had years to talk to her about this stuff. So I really think it is the stories, and I think that people should tell their stories, and if it seems as if no one wants to listen, I've heard some interesting strategies. You mentioned people giving things away before
mm-hmm.
they die. I think that's great. If we can
mm-hmm.
start giving things away, some people will actually put a little tag on the back of the object if it has an interesting story that says at least a thumbnail sketch of what this was all about. In our case, it was, as you know, a military family, and so they had traveled widely, and yet they had a furniture allowance. They were able to carry things with them. And one of the things I discovered in doing research was that the Army wives, even in the most desolate of places, would carry as much as they could of their china and their linens, and maybe
sure.
if they had silver, their silver, to say, I am somebody. You know, this is who I am. And it also made them feel more at home. And I think we all do that, too. We try to make we want our little nest of comfort. So the things have all of those stories in them, who it belonged to, why they kept it, why they passed it on to us, and all of that. And I think we need to tell those stories. And maybe, you know, the young people will be more interested than we think. But in any case, I'm kind of in the middle of my life here, so I have some very young relatives. And up to a certain point, they are interested, and then they become teenagers, and they're not interested for a while. But, you know, it's really the story that gives the thing its value. And even on the Antiques Roadshow, you know, part of the point of the value of truly valuable antiques is that their story goes back a long way.
And oh, absolutely. And about your grandmother.
Yes.
Is it Elizabeth Bess Egbert?
Yes, Elizabeth Egbert, and her nickname was Bess. And then she married Charlie Kilborn, so she became Elizabeth Kilborn. And that name, Elizabeth, was handed down in the family in a way that some families do that. And she was, as I discovered when I did some research, she was born in the 1870s. She was a little girl, actually, in Apache territory in Arizona. I never knew that.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the things I found out. Another thing I realized as I did my research was that this brother of my mother's, who died when he was a young teenager, he was a Down syndrome child. I finally found a picture of him that was labeled. And then I understood some heartbreak that was in this family that they never talked about, because people in those days were very formal, and they kind of kept their griefs to themselves. And that's another thing that we realize about when you start delving into family stories, you find out stories, but you also understand some things about how these people lived and what kind of people they were, you know? And that's very rewarding. It's well worth the trouble of trying to locate whatever family documents we can, go back to whatever town we think they might have come from. The U.S. Census can be really helpful in this. The genealogical records that the Mormons keep can be really helpful. It's like putting together a patchwork quilt, and it's full of surprises, you know?
That's the truth, including in your book, Objects of Our Affection. In here, you've got some wonderful photographs. I was intrigued with the Sendai chest. I have not seen anything really like it, and there's a story with this.
The Sendai chest, we believe, was brought back from the China. My grandfather, as a military officer, went into the Boxer Rebellion, which was happening in Peking in around 1902. And this chest is like an officer's campaign chest. It has a kind of weird handle that slides down inside when it's not being used. And these handles are on both ends of the chest so that someone could run a pole through it, and then two men could pick it up on their shoulders and carry it. And it's something you'll see copied, for instance, in Pier 1 or Bombay Company or those kinds of places, mm-hmm. because it was something that came from the Orient. But this particular chest also was made of sandalwood, which has a very sweet, pungent smell, and that would help preserve linens and things against insects. And it was one way that people kept their fabrics, kept them from being eaten up by moths and things. And so the whole thing is full of the story, not only of him and the battle and how he might have perhaps found this chest, brought it back as kind of a trophy, and then it just became part of the family's life. It had a beautiful metal frieze of what I called dragons, and I later learned they're actually called foo dogs, and they're a good luck symbol. On the front of it, a hammered iron, very thin. It was a beautiful chest. But at a certain point, it was very heavy, very delicate, and we knew that we could not really take the best care of all of these things mm-hmm. in our lives, and so we sort of gave them up in the hope that they would go to some place where they would be a very special object to someone. And that's what I came out of at the end of the auction. I was haunted for quite a while by the things we'd let go of, mm-hmm. but then I thought, you know, they've got a new life, and already someone's putting a new story into these things. And that was kind of comforting. I think
we can let go. Being a lover of antiques, my husband and I both are lovers of antiques, and we like the stories. And what you're saying is true. I have some pieces of furniture that I can tell a story just about everything that I've got. And people
yes.
go, wow, how'd you find out about that? Well, this is what went on. And that for me, I've always loved stories. Like you said, the Antique Roadshow, that is one of the mesmerizing things. It's not
yes.
just the value, but it's this aunt maybe that was on the Titanic or somebody
yes.
else that had battled Geronimo, and this is a bullet. You know, nobody makes these bullets anymore because it was only made for the one gun that so-and-so had on his hip.
Yes.
I mean, it's really, and you never know where you're going to find him.
It's true. And I also found, to me, that the Canton China represented my grandmother in my mind. The Canton China is this beautiful rose and pink and green and red and black china that has these intricate little people on it. It's very intricately done. And to me, what it represented is that my grandmother was pregnant 7 times, and because of the way life was in those days, only one child, my mom, lived to adulthood. And yet, so the china, though it was so fragile, outlived them all.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to me like a paradox, because you would think the china would break, but no, it was the lives in a way that broke. And so that story becomes infused in the china. But in a general way, doing the research, I also learned about Canton china, how it was made, how the Europeans envied this process that the Chinese had perfected, but they just couldn't figure out how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So they imported the china, and how the Chinese were very smart, and they realized what a demand there was, and they started these they called them pattern chests, which was they'd send a chest of the china and then you could select what you wanted. It was the precursor of a catalog. And they mass produced the stuff finally. One man would paint one tiny, he'd be the one who painted all the faces on it or something, mm-hmm. you know? So they were really way ahead of us in a way at the, you know, back in the 1800s, they already were doing all of this. And I learned this because I went to find out more about my grandmother's china. And so as you said, it is so fascinating. If you know the specific story that's in the object, that's great. But just what that object represented in its culture is also fascinating.
Oh, it is. You just never know where people have been or how they get things or how they were gifted them. It's really fun. Now, you had a bag of what you called odd table silver.
Yes.
And you really enjoyed going through that. You had interesting, were they napkin rings from West Point?
Yes. Actually, there were two napkin rings from West Point. My grandfather and my father both went to West Point. My dad was class of 1924. And the family story was that one night he and my mother, who were normally very civilized people, got into an argument and he flung his napkin ring down the table and it whisked past her ear and went through the glass of the front door. And this was in the middle of World War II, and so they were in a blackout in Washington, and they went out with this flashlight looking for the napkin ring. And it was very, you know, not at all how I remembered them. They were very quiet, sedate people as I knew them, but my sister remembered when they were younger and more volatile. So these, you know, but the silver, every piece of silver slowed me down the day that I was trying to empty that chest, because there were all these napkin rings, and some of them I remembered from my childhood and sitting around my grandparents' table, and the grown-ups had the good silver napkin rings and we had plastic ones. And I took some of them out and used them with my son mm-hmm. as he was growing up, and we would use napkins, you know, they weren't great, you know, linen, but they were cloth napkins, and that was, you know, sort of a nod to the environment instead of using paper napkins. And so then we got to bring out the napkin rings and bring out the stories a little bit and try to pass the stories on, and he was interested, you know. So every piece had a story. And when I got to my mother's silver, I remembered her telling me that her mother-in-law had picked out the pattern, and that really rankled my mother. She was very grumpy about it, but there she was sort of with this pattern. And so there was a family feud type of story in that part of the treasure trove. And the stories, they do just really go on and on. And I had the thought as I was, as we were starting today, that we know now that the level of objects that the Gilded Age began with back in the late 1800s, we sort of inherited that in the 20th century, and we thought it was great to have all these things. And now we know that that's not completely sustainable. So I just say that we can let go of some of the things, but hope that the stories are what outlive us, perhaps, instead of the stuff.
Well, what I find so intriguing is that people collect the oddest things. And I remember my grandmother, and she lived to be almost 92, and I remember before seeing her the year before she died, and of course I had memories of being in her house when I was a child, but she was sort of like a pack rat, and I looked at all the things that she had, and in my mind, many of those items were like junk, but I knew they were from the early 1900 period, and because she had seen World War I, she had seen World War II, and there were a lot of things. And she was one of these people, she was a tourist picker up, a tourist itemy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
I would think, you know, some collectors would just go bonkers over these things. And
yes.
I look at them and I go, oh, you've got to be kidding. But it represents a story. I never found out what those stories were, but it's amazing. Now, you had two things that I found intriguing. One was the set of pistols.
Yes.
And the other was the George Washington chair.
Yes.
Now, tell us about both of those.
All right. The story with the pistols was the name Burr, B-U-R-R, is in our family. And the story that my mother told me, these are beautiful 18th century dueling pistols. They're gorgeous. They're fairly simple, but they have engraved metal on them. They're in their case. They have all their little tools with them. It's in very good condition. The story was that these were Aaron Burr's dueling pistols. And my mother would always say, not those pistols, of course, not the pistols with which he shot Alexander Hamilton. No, no, no. Just some other pistols that he had. Well, it's possible. That's a story I haven't been able to trace. We don't know as much about my father's family as we do about my mother's. But we did know that one of his grandfathers was named Burr Tracy. So that was as like Aaron Burr's last name. And that's kind of where that story rests. We have these gorgeous pistols, and they might have belonged to someone important, which, of course, is interesting to know. But if you can't absolutely prove the provenance of them, they're not worth as much. And if we were ever going to try to sell them, we would try to prove the provenance. The George Washington chair, we did put in the auction. The family story about that was that that an ancestor of ours, my great-great-grandfather, I think, had picked it up at auction in the early 1800s in Philadelphia, and that it had been in the house where the Washingtons lived when Philadelphia briefly was the capital of the United States. I determined that indeed this man had lived in Philadelphia, my great-great-grandfather. He was a medical man, and he studied at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. His family was from there. And finally, late one night on the website of the Historical Society of Pennsylvania, I discovered that there had indeed been an auction in the late 1700s or the early, I think it was the late 1700s, as the Washingtons were leaving to go back to Mount Vernon. And it was a house that belonged to Robert Morris, who I knew was an important historical figure at the time of the Revolution. And the Washingtons had used his house, and I know exactly where it is because I worked in Philadelphia. And that house doesn't exist any longer, but I know where it would be. And there was an auction on Market Street, right as our family story said. So I cannot positively say that this chair belonged to Washington, but it could have, because it said on the Historical Society site, the auction is advertised, and one of the things, of all things that it mentions, it says, and a set of fine satin-bottomed chairs. And I talked with the historians and curators at the Independence National Historic Park, and they said, well, this picture you've sent us is Louis XVI, and your appraiser says it's genuine because she's checked the wood and the paint and everything. And we don't have a record of that specific chair, but we do know that George Washington had French furniture, so it is possible, we can't tell you. And I thought that was fascinating because all of these pieces that I was able to amass of, you know, sort of documentary evidence suggest that it's a possibility, but we can't say for sure. And in a way, that's almost more fun because it's a mystery, but we're so close to a solution. And so that's the story of the George Washington chair. At auction, as it so happened, a cousin of ours bought it. And, you know, the auctioneers had said, of course, immediate family can't bid. That wouldn't be right. And we thought that made sense. And I said, well, we have these cousins. And he said, oh, that's fine. Well, you know, they did end up getting the chair. So if we ever wanted to try to pursue more of the provenance, I think we could do that because we could take samples from it and have it, you know, dated. But that's as far as we got, but it was a fascinating process. And I don't know if you've done anything like that in your sleuthing, but I found it really, really interesting.
No, I don't think I'd have a lot of patience for that, but I admire and appreciate the fact that you did. Now, you had one other item in your family, and you've got some nice photographs of these items, which I think is terrific. You called it the red chair. It was
Yes. Your
grandfather's red chair, and you said there was a ghost that came with the chair. So we got to hear the ghost story.
Well, it did almost seem that way, because this was the chair that my grandfather always sat in, and he was an Army general. He was one of the most decorated men of his time. He was the man who built the Malinta Tunnel on Corregidor, which helped protect the Philippines against the Japanese during World War II. So he was a major player in his own right. This chair, in my mind, kind of resembles him, and I still have the chair. It has sort of a slender waist, and then it's back. It's an upholstered chair. It's an upholstered armchair with wood, you know, beautiful dark wood around it. And its back kind of flares, almost like shoulders. And that's how he was. He was this tall, slender man, but with broad shoulders. and very quiet and gentle with children, but as we have heard, fierce in wartime. And the thing that I realized about the chair is it always sat in a particular spot in the living room of the house that he lived in with my grandmother. And from where he sat, he had almost a 360-degree view of everything around him. From windows and doors, he could see the street if someone came through the front door. I don't think he did that on purpose, but on a subconscious level, he was a military man, and that was a great vantage point. After my mother died, I took that chair back to the suburbs of Philadelphia with me, where I was living as I was working at the Philadelphia Inquirer. And what I noticed was no one would ever sit in it. You know, it was on one side of my fireplace, and my wingback chair that was my favorite chair that I sat in was on the other side, and then there was a sofa. People would sort of not sit in the chair, and I kind of had to laugh because it was almost as if he was still in it. Of course, I knew he wasn't in it, but on the other hand, it must have had some aura about it because people just longest time didn't sit in it. Now that we've moved back to my hometown where his house was, and I'm actually living in the house that he and my grandmother built, and our family is there, and the younger members of the family just, they hasten to go sit in that chair. They have no shyness about it at all. So I guess his ghost, if it's there, it welcomes the young'uns.
The auction. When we hear about auctions, and here we've been talking about these wonderful items that were in your mother's home that you did research on, which I think for any family member, if they have the opportunity and the patience to do it, because it takes time. It really does.
Yes.
So you have a lot of history in your family that you didn't know anything about prior, so that's a plus when we're going through these items. But what was it like for you when you and your sister were doing this auction? I mean, how long did it take? How many pieces did you have to sell? What was the process like? We may have some listeners that are looking at something like that. I just got an email from someone that I know. Her mother is elderly. She's going through all kinds of health problems. She's going to have to deal with something like this. What would you say to my listeners?
It's a very good question. The stuff was stored in Virginia. I was in the Philadelphia area. My sister was in upstate New York, so we were doing a lot of this by telephone. I went to an antiques dealer in our hometown who I knew had known my mother and liked her very much, and I asked him for advice, and he recommended an auction house. Mm-hmm. The stuff was in storage. I came down from Philadelphia, and I met with a man from the auction house who was in a nearby town, and we went to the storage bins, and he looked at everything, and he said, yes, we would take this kind of stuff on. We do a lot of this kind of estate work. And so we agreed they would be the ones who did it. And then we had to move the furniture closer to where their auction house was, which we did. They assessed it all. They had an appraiser who assessed it all and, put a value on it. And they cataloged it. They made a catalog. They advertised it. We set a date for the auction. It was probably about 9 months from the time we started looking at it until the auction itself. And the auction itself was in 2003, I think. And so a lot of the premises we might have gone into when we first started thinking about the auction were pre-2001. And everything really changed in 2001, because of September 11th. And so who knows? But so in a way, it was the auction straddled that momentous event and tragic event. And in a way, it sort of changed things, I think. But we went ahead with it, and then we came to the day of the auction itself. How we decided what to put in the auction, we probably auctioned maybe 100 or so items, including china and stuff and a lot of furniture. My mother had us divide things up when she was still alive. One day she came into the living room when we were visiting her, and she held out straws and said, draw. And whoever drew the short straw started, and that was me, and I took the sofa. And then my sister took the portrait. And she said, I want you to make a list. I don't want you all arguing over things after I'm gone. And by the way, I think that's a great idea. A lot of people have told me that they were promised this or that, and then someone else got it. Well, my mother was right. Make a list. And so we made our list that day. We took turns choosing, so it was completely fair. And if you had five people, you could still do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Everybody takes their turn, and then you go around again. It doesn't matter how many people there are. I would recommend that. My sister had typed the lists up. We both had a copy of the lists. And so we got our lists out, and on the phone, we went through, And we both wanted to put enough valuable things in the auction that we would draw a good crowd,
mm-hmm.
and not just throw in stuff we didn't care about. And so we agonized, but we both gave up some things that were dear to us, and then the things we didn't care about so much were easier, as you said, that, you know, why did my great aunt, you know, have this thing, whatever, let it go.
Right.
There's that kind of stuff as well. And then the day of the auction itself, we went, and the auctioneers had said, oh, you don't have to do this. But we felt as if we were kind of escorting the family out on its last journey, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it would have felt kind of like a betrayal not to go and say goodbye. And so we did, and we winced and we squirmed, and, you know, some of the stuff sold for a lot more than we would have thought. But many of the pieces, especially the big wooden pieces, sold for just, at one point my sister said you couldn't even buy the wood in
right.
that for what we just sold it for. She kind of between gritted teeth. And it was tough being there. And afterwards, the auctioneer said, this is why we tell people you don't need to come. But, you know, I'm glad we did, because
mm-hmm.
we know and we have closure. And it took a while for the closure to sort of sink in for me. But once it did, as I told you, I felt really a sense almost of relief. I think we did the right thing.
Yeah.
We couldn't manage all of that stuff. And it was beautiful furniture, a lot of it, but we couldn't manage it. And what happened was that instead of a whole house full of it, there's maybe one piece in someone's house that's a real showpiece for them. And that they have their own story about how they got it and why they wanted this particular piece. And so the furniture goes
on.
It goes on into a new life.
This book, Objects of Our Affection, has a wonderful cover on it of antique silver that obviously has been used a lot. But her stories of family history, her journey of dealing with her mother's estate, is one that I think is fascinating to read. It'll touch your heart. It'll touch your mind. Lisa Tracy has been my guest. Lisa, do you have a website? We've got about 30 seconds here before we'll have to say goodbye.
Yes, please. www.objectsofouraffection.com. Objects of Our Affection is all one word. www.objectsofouraffection.com.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Lisa.
Thank you,
and
Donna.
It's wonderful that you took time to write this out and share your experience, because I know a lot of people will enjoy it. This is Donna Siebel. We're taking a break. Don't forget, objectsofouraffection.com. We'll be taking a break and be right back. Don't go away.
Welcome, my lords and ladies, to the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, located at Maris Farms in Buckley, Washington. For 3 weekends in August, starting August 7th and 8th, we will transport you back to the days of old, where magic and merriment reign. Come see the multitude of musicians, dancers, jugglers, gypsies, peasants, nobles, pirates, and prestidigitation. That's magic for you commoners. Learn to swing a sword or shoot a bow and be knighted by Her Majesty the Queen. Hold your breath as jousters wheel their mounts around to engage in full contact combat on the field of battle. Sign on to sail the seas with scurvy pirates, or sit down with friends and family for turkey legs and a fine brewed ale. Delights abound for the young and old at the Washington Midsummer Renaissance Fair, so come one and all, starting August 7th and 8th, for fun and excitement, and may your day be fair. For tickets and info, go to www.washingtonfair.com.
Donna Siebel publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hello and welcome back. This is Donna Siebel, 888-815-9756. Yes, 888-815-9756. If you would like to let me chat with you today, light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, I'd be glad to do that for you. I've got a number of things I'd like to share with you. If you'd like to call in and chat, I'll do that too. Don't forget, the Washington Renaissance Midsummer Fair is coming up. It's hard to believe. It's starting on the first weekend of August, the 7th and 8th. It'll be going on for 3 weekends until the 21st and 22nd. I have 2 passes left. These are family passes. If you live in the state of Washington and you would like to get a free family pass for 2 adults and 2 children, by golly, I've only got 2 left, so be sure you call me, because in, gee whiz, it's like week after next we're starting up. Can you believe how fast the time is flying by? Well, I guess that's the way it is when you're having fun and enjoying what you do. So anyway, give me a call at my office. That's the quickest way to reach me, or via email, whatever is your pleasure. If you're in the state of Washington and you'd like to attend this event on any one of these 3 weekends, then all you have to do is call me at 800-872-8852, and I'll pop it off in the mail to you. And then also, I have my email, which is Donna@DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna@DelphiInternational.com. Now, by the way, that same email address will do for those of you that would like to contribute to my upcoming book about stories about the paranormal, psychic, unique experiences. I'd love to hear about them. Unique coincidences, synchronicity, all of these terms convey something that to many people is unknown. So your story could have an opportunity of influencing or making someone aware that they don't need to be concerned about the paranormal, that it is there and that it is something that often brings a gift that is unexpected. So if you have that special story, I'm aiming to collect 100 of them, then what I'd like for you to do is send it along to me. And again, use the same email address, DelphiDonna@DelphiInternational.com. And don't forget to put your contact information in there, because I will need to have that. Well, who's going to be coming up this week? We've got a wonderful lineup. Robert Moss is going to be my guest tomorrow. We're going to be talking about dreams, dream gates. And then on Wednesday, we're going to be talking about health. It's all about consciousness. Do you believe in the mind-body connection? Well, Ivan Rados is the gentleman that we're going to be discussing this with. And Marie Jones, who's been on my show before about different subject matter, she and her associate have put out a book called Deja Vu. That always has a fascinating sound to it. Have you experienced something where you felt like you've been there before and you'd never seen it in your life? Well, I know my husband had an experience like that about Moscow. And we'll find out about that on Thursday. And then Stanton Friedman, yes, the UFO guy, is going to be on with us. He's going to be on Friday, and he and another associate put together a book called Science Was Wrong. We put such faith in science, and many, many times those that are deemed the experts poo-poo the dreams and capacities of those who have a bigger vision than they do. Fascinating talk about history and science and what didn't happen and why. Stanton Friedman. So we have a wonderful, wonderful lineup of guests. Now, for next month, that list of guests will be going up. And then also, I want to let you know I'm going to be at the Ren Fair. That's right, the first 3 weekends in August. I will be there every single weekend. I'll be in costume. And also, look for my booth. It will have bright yellow banners with gigantic red lions on it. Yes, yes, yes. And I will be there doing mini readings for people, which I always enjoy doing. When I was going through the book Objects of Our Affection, many different concepts and points of information pop into my mind, and sometimes little things like a salt shaker can have a significant meaning to someone, as it did in her book. It was all about her mom and the relationship of this particular salt shaker that was very much a part of their family. Well, as I was preparing for the show, I came across something relating to salt. There's little links there. And this is about spilling salt. Now, I am partially Italian. My father came from Italy, the old country. And there was a tradition among the Italians. If you spilt salt, you ought to always pick up a little bit and throw it over your shoulder. Now, I honestly can't tell you whether it was my right or my left shoulder, but I just knew it had to go over a shoulder. So if you ever have me visit your house and you find salt on the floor, you'll know why, because I've thrown it over a shoulder due to an Italian tradition. However, in doing a little research on this, the spilling of salt goes back a long way. It has a history to it that I had not really been aware of. It goes back, to the best of our known knowledge, to a legend that tells about the value of salt. Now, today we have so much abundance. My goodness, you got 1,001 different types of salts that you can buy. They come from all over the world, from different environments. Some have high mineral content. Others have something else in them. But salt has been more valuable than gold many, many times. And this is the legend as it was related. So long ago, there was a king that had three daughters, and he asked each of them to describe the depth of their love for him. The first daughter said, "Oh, father, I love you as much as I love bread." The second daughter said, "Father, I love you as much as I love wine." Oh, maybe you could understand that one. And the third said, "I love you as much as I would salt." Well, you might sit there if you were the king and wonder about that, right? Well, he was really upset. The king was upset with that third daughter. He was offended because he had likened her, or she had likened him, to being like salt. Well, she was banished. And she stayed banished until when the daughter, she conspired with the palace cook. And she arranged a totally salt-free meal for her father. Can you imagine what he said? "What's the matter with you? You're not cooking very good today. This stuff tastes blah. It's bland." And the cook said, "You have no value for salt. You don't feel salt is important. So I didn't put anything in here to salt it up." The light went on the brain, in the brain department of the king. He realized that he cannot live without salt. So using salt as an example was a very good value. Now, apparently this particular story dates back to Roman times. But in the ancient world, salt was extremely valuable as a preservative. We take refrigeration for granted today. We no more spend time canning like I remember my grandmother doing. I mean, her whole summer was all about canning and or preserving meat. And goodness, just about everywhere you went, those people of the older generation, they have very vivid memories of this because they couldn't preserve food without salt or sugar. And it's also antiseptic. It adds flavor. Salt was really, really revered. And among the Greeks, the Romans, and the Hebrews, it was a common sacrificial offering. Now, interestingly, in the Middle East, it was a token of friendship and trust. So when someone would spill this very, very special element that we take so much for granted today, it was considered an affront. So the association of spilled salt with bad luck goes way back. So it did not arise, as often thought, with Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, where Judas has knocked over the salt cellar. Leonardo da Vinci was depicting something that's very old in culture. Now, what you do if you want to counter-effect the bad luck of spilling salt is throwing a little bit over your left shoulder. Remember I told you that I couldn't remember whether it was over the right or over the left. Well, it is over the left. And historically, this gesture was seen as appeasing the spilling of the salt. It's an informal sacrifice. Or, with Central European folklore, it says that the devil can't abide salt, so the left shoulder ploy may be a way to hit that invisible devil in the eye. The left shoulder, perhaps, according to some historians, depicts that which is not positive. The right shoulder does. Most people are right-handed, so that's what they did. They decided they would do it that way. But anyway, I just thought that little bit of trivia you might be interested in gives you a whole different perspective on salt, doesn't it? And today, it's one of the leading industries throughout the world. People have fought wars over salt. They used to be paid in salt because it was that valuable. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. The telephone number is 888-815-9756. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I have some very nice thoughts from a very special individual. Also, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Remember we were talking about a collections or antiques? Boy, have I got something to share with you. You think you know it all. Wait until you hear about the guy with the tennis shoes. Woo! This is Donna. We'll be back in just a minute.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Collections, collectors, who collects what? Why do they collect what they collect? It's anybody's guess. You never know. I've got a collection of Scottish Terriers in my wildest dreams I never thought I'd end up with. Why? Because we have 2 Scottish Terriers. We've had Terriers for years. And people just will see them, they'll say, oh, that's Donna, and they'll bring it over. In fact, I know somebody's got something in mind for me already. They said, oh, I'll know what to get you whenever I see something that's a Scottish Terrier. And I went, uh-oh, here we go, because I've got more Scottish Terriers in my home than I ever thought I would have. Well, there are other people that have acquired collections, and some of them have been acquired not because they set out to do it, just because they were working and ended up getting a collection. One of those individuals is Alan Freed. He worked for 39 years inside the airport in Washington, D.C. He also worked on runways. And his collection consisted of locks that people had lost. Now, in 39 years, you would be amazed at how many locks he found. He got 11,000 of these. They had somehow or another become separated from people's luggage and found in the airport. He said the dummy padlock, and I've got a photo of it in front of me. It's just like a padlock. It is made from all 11,000 of these, and it's 43 by 34 by 20 inches. Incredible. Well, someone else decided they were going to collect frogs. Now, this is a lady in England. She got a cute little bright green China frog in 1979. Well, she got frogitis. She got it bad. By 2005, she had a collection of 11,471 pieces. Can you imagine dusting all of that? I wonder if she put it in bins somewhere. That's what my girlfriend did with her Beanie Babies. I never ask her how many she's got. She's got bins of them. Well, this lady found she had to move to a bigger house to accommodate her collection. However, she found she had to move again. This time, she had to go to a smaller place. So she ended up having to sell all of her Froggy collection at auction because she couldn't take it with her. Whew. Can you imagine that many frogs in your house? Whew. Well, there's another guy. What he decided to do was do prayer beads. Now, that makes sense. He said that he is from Kuwait. He's an architect. He's been collecting these precious prayer beads since 1979, and he has over 2,000 of them. And most of them are made from amber. And he said he flies all around the world just to collect one stone. In total, he has, it's a good thing these things are prayer beads, 56,000 pieces. 56,000 pieces. Now, these aren't all prayer beads either. I have to tell you, he's got, from his travels, various antiques and curios, and that includes 200-year-old carpets and 14th-century silverware. He must own a warehouse. My husband once met a person who was a world traveler, and he was invited to this person's home. He walked into this home, which wasn't very big, and he said, every single inch of the walls, the tables, the bookcases, even parts of the ceiling, were covered with valuable items. And he was in a very nondescript building. It absolutely amazed him. He found out that this person had come from royalty and that they had come from a certain part of the country, and they had these things right there all around them because in the country that they had escaped from, they couldn't keep them there. They managed to smuggle them out, believe it or not. But he said it was absolutely mind-boggling. So can you imagine 56,000 pieces? I can't even begin to think about that. Donna Sebo here, and I want to share some thoughts with you before we close out the program today. And this is by Scott London. These are by Scott London, I should say. And I'm going to quote him directly. He said, people often define genius as a set of character traits or a way of being. Books instruct us on how to think like Einstein or Leonardo da Vinci. But Scott sees genius as the fulfillment of our true calling in life, as the flowering of our unique potential, whatever it happens to be. Scott says, what is the good of thinking like Einstein if you're a Picasso or a Charlie Chaplin? Why act like Mozart if you're a Maya Lin or a Tiger Woods? Every genius inhabits a universe of his or her own making, so imitating the behavior of others is pointless. And the reason I wanted to close the show out with that thought is so many times we expect that we're supposed to mimic or be just like so-and-so. How many times have you had someone say to you, if you were only like Georgie, you would be so much better. Why can't you be like Bongo Bongo over there? Well, you're not. You're yourself. Now, I'm not just talking about manners here, because lots of times adults will say things like this. But the uniqueness of quality that you have as a person, as an individual, your creativity, your happiness, your essence, it is yours. And there's only one of you. So as you go about your day, enjoy yourself. Enjoy who you are. If you have special talents, develop them. Don't feel like you are a misfit, because you're not. You're your own unique creation. Whether you make the best pancakes in the world at a little restaurant in Pickles, Wyoming, it doesn't make any difference. What it is who you are and that you give the very best that you have. Because you do make a difference. This is Donna Siebel. Tomorrow we're talking dreams. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You don't belong to anybody else. You belong to yourself. Remember that. If somebody ever asks about why you're so different, just say, it's okay. That's just the way I turned out. Isn't it amazing? You're amazing. This is Donna Siebel. Have an absolutely awesome day, and we'll be talking tomorrow. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.